I'm Grady Booch, and this is my column on architecture, Facing Future. My grandfather came into this world at a time when human-generated information could be transmitted long distances no faster than a horse, assuming you were wealthy enough to own one of your own, or a train, assuming you were wealthy enough to afford a ticket. By the time my father was born in 1902, there had been a sea change in the velocity of information. Human-generated messages could now travel at the speed of light. The telegraph and the telephone were both part of the fabric of contemporary life. There was a vibrant telecommunications industry whose innovative products were lubricating the gears of commerce. Guglielmo Marconi was just beginning to figure out radio, and Henry Ford had yet to fill the roads with the Model T. And, a year before my father was born, the Eastman Kodak Company was formed. Ford and his friend Thomas Edison knew a lot about innovation. Their inventions, coupled with indefatigable marketing, proved to be incredibly disruptive to the businesses of that day, changing the economics of transportation, work, and entertainment within a decade. Ford was rumored to have once said, "If I'd asked customers what they wanted, they would have said, a faster horse." Both Ford and Edison understood that the key to success was a practice of continuous disruptive innovation that delivered real, measurable value. Jump ahead one generation. Ford strayed from those values for a period, and the Japanese auto manufacturers rose to dominance to fill the vacuum of new ideas. Kodak completely lost its way in the sea change of a new digital world. Apple clothed itself intimately in the mantle of innovation to become one of the world's most valued companies. It's fair to say that software is the engine that drives contemporary innovation. As Cory Doctorow observed in his keynote at the 28th Chaos Communications Congress, December 2011, a car is just a computer I put my body into. Smartphones are networked computers that incidentally allow you to use telephony protocols to translate information. From farm to fork, produce is grown, analyzed, transported, and tracked by software-intensive systems. Through social networks, we may count dozens, if not hundreds, of people as our friends, most of whom are not physically close enough to call over to watch a movie or move a piece of heavy furniture or rescue us when things go bump in the night. Some of them will never meet in the flesh. Speaking of friends, Facebook is certainly an example of a contemporary company that has delivered disruptive technology through the vehicle of software-intensive systems. Love 'em or leave 'em, reality is that when you're on the path to having an installed base of a billion people, you're probably doing something very right. Just to be clear, I don't work for Facebook. I have no active engagements with Facebook, and my story here is my own and does not necessarily represent that of Facebook or IBM or anyone dead or living or yet to be born. I spent a little time at Facebook a few years ago. I've talked with some of its principal developers, and I've studied its architecture. From my analysis, as an outsider who knows one or two things about the culture of complex software-intensive systems, well, Facebook has a looming architectural governance problem. A process of continuous innovation bogs down when you get trapped in the products of your own making. As Clayton Christensen observes in The Innovator's Dilemma, the most successful companies are often the victims of their own success unless they take steps to intentionally resist stepping into that bog. Ford took its eyes off its customers for a while. Kodak came late to the party. Facebook is still on a path whose second derivative of change is a positive number, so it doesn't yet feel the threat of a looming bog. When I last visited the company, Facebook had only 100 or so developers, the bulk of whom who fit cozily in one large war room. Honestly, it was a little indistinguishable from a really nice college computer lab. Nice work desks, great workstations, places where you could fuel up with caffeine and sugar. Dinner was served right there, so you never need leave. Were I a 20-something with only a dog and a futon to my name, it would have been geek heaven. The code base at the time was, by my estimate, small enough that it was grokkable, and the major functional bits were not so large and were sufficiently loosely coupled such that development could proceed along nearly independent threads of progress. Recently, I read that Facebook plans to double in size this coming year. Oh my, the changes they are coming. There comes a point of no return in the life of every successful software-intensive system, a point where you can no longer place a pile of your best developers at one end of a lever and expect them to move the world. Rather, you must come to realize that putting piles of developers at the end of even the longest lever is no longer the right tool to use. Crossing that point, while still preserving the values and the tribal memory of your organization's development culture, requires some serious adult supervision. Just to be clear, there are certain limited conditions under which the maxim, give me PHP and a place to stand and I will move the world, holds true. Those conditions include having a modest code base with no legacy friction, growth, acceptance, and limited competition that masks inefficiencies, a hyper-energetic, maniacally focused group of developers who all fit pretty much in the same room. Relax any of those constraints, and developing really, really hard just doesn't cut it anymore. Consider this. The moment you break a development organization across offices, you introduce communication and coordination challenges. Add the crossing of time zones, and unless you've got some governance in place, architectural rot will slowly creep in. Interfaces will either ossify or blur, and the flaws in your development culture will be magnified. The subtly different development cultures that will evolve in each office will yield different textures of code. It's kind of like the evolutionary drift on which Darwin reported. If your architecture is well structured, well syndicated, and well governed, you can more easily split the work across groups, even if there is no explicit intentional architecture. But, as longtime readers of my column will know, every software-intensive system has an architecture, intentional or not, explicit or invisible. If your architecture is poorly structured, held in the tribal memory of only a few, and ungoverned, then you can rely on heroics for a while, but that's unsustainable. Your heroes will dig in, burn out, or cash out. Just to be clear, I'm not picking on Facebook. What's happening here is a story that every group that it's the threshold of complexity must face. If you are outsourcing to India or China or across a city, if you are growing your staff to the point where the important architectural decisions no longer will fit in one guy's head, if you no longer have the time to just rewrite everything, if your growing customer base grows increasingly intolerant of capricious changes, then, like it or not, you've got to inject more discipline. Now, I'm not advocating extreme high ceremony measures. As a start, some fundamentals will go a long way. Establish a well-instrumented and well-automated build and release system. Use collaboration tools that channel work, but also allow for serendipitous connections. Codify and syndicate the system's load-bearing walls and architectural decisions. Create a culture of patterns and fierce refactoring. Remind your developers that what each of them do is valued. Remind them there is more to life than coding. It will be interesting to watch how Facebook metabolizes its growth. Some organizations are successful in so doing, many are not. But I really do wish Facebook success. It is through the past few years of interesting times, my message to the company is that the really interesting times are only now beginning. And I hope it enjoys the journey.